I'm Colleen Luckett for EDUCAUSE Now.
And I'm Jerry Bain.
So, I have a question for you in the realm of science.
Okay.
What do you think is the average length of time it takes to develop a gene-based drug, from the point of identifying a gene to creating the medicine?
5 years.
Nope, try again.
10 years?
It actually takes 17 years to develop a gene-based drug. That can literally be a lifetime for those suffering from a disease. But what if we could speed up the research process? That's just what the Science Commons Project is trying to do by helping scientists make their data reusable, by streamlining the materials transfer process, and by helping researchers analyze and use data from disparate sources.
Amazing. And on this episode of EDUCAUSE Now, we talk with John Wilbanks, Vice President of Science Commons, about how they're taking science research to the next level.
We see that creators, digital photographers, bloggers have begun to embrace Creative Commons licensing as a way to get their work more distributed on the internet. How does that fit in the sciences?
We'll also give you a little taste of a debate between instructional technologist Jim Groom and Professor Gardner Campbell on the merits of EduPunk.
From a video we'll be releasing in February.
Also, we have a guest commentary this month from John Fritz, Vice President of Instructional Technology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
He'll be reading an excerpt from his essay, How to Get Faculty to Do What You Want.
And if you're interested in finding out more about what you hear in today's episode, visit the show notes at connect.educause.edu/now.
Imagine a scientist, driven to find a cure for a deadly disease. To find this cure, she must study an obscure protein in the body. A search tells her that there are more than 2,000 research articles on this protein. Perhaps her budget allows for an elite subscription to all the research journals, but behind her, there are thousands of scientists from around the globe who cannot access this information. They're lost as potential collaborators. But that's not the only problem. If our scientist reads an article a day, it'll take her 5 years to acquire the knowledge found in those research articles, not to mention all the tangential information she'd want to look up. And these are just the documents. The average time it takes for the development of a life-saving drug is 17 years. Research and data are often fiercely protected by universities and corporations, so knowledge is often balkanized, lost in databases, or locked up in contracts. This can lead to redundant research, as isolated scientists are left to follow blind alleys, because knowledge is not being shared freely among researchers. But there is an effort to change all of this, to create an environment of openness and encourage the sharing of knowledge. It's a project under the umbrella of Creative Commons, called the Science Commons Project. John Wilbanks is the Vice President of Science Commons, and he says that for real progress to be made, we need to stop thinking in terms of printed media.
So that's where you get the 3-page journal article form of writing. It comes from that old limitation of print media. And that's where you get ideas like we shouldn't convey all of the data with it because that's too expensive. And you get an entire culture that goes along with this idea of the paper. The fact that we even call these things scientific papers sort of tells you how big of a gulf we still have. So we're trying to get people to think about hyperlinking in what they do, to understand that the limitations of cost and transmission imposed by an analog print world have really begun to evaporate.
What if there were a semantic web for science, a way for knowledge to be shared, reused, and extracted in very directed ways that might speed up the process of acquiring materials and permissions surrounding data?
If you think about what the web did, the web brought together all these previously disparate resources that you had to connect to via Gopher and Waze, and you had to sort of combine it all behind your own firewall. And the web really leveled that. All you have to do is put up a web server. You don't have to worry about connecting documents. You just put it on the web, and Google finds it, as long as it's hyperlinked. So the idea is to really make that same push for scholarly content, but to try to do along the way to say, well, if we have to reformat this stuff anyway, let's take a jump. And let's make it legally open if it's digital content. Let's make it legally open and digitally described if it's a physical material. And let's use this next generation format to get it into a knowledge network instead of just a document network.
Of course, creating an open regime of sharing and reuse in the sciences is a complicated proposition. The Science Commons Project started by spending a year analyzing the research cycle of scientists because it wasn't immediately clear, outside of research documents and papers, where licensing made sense. At systematic points along the process, they found blockages where a common license might loosen up information sharing.
So there's a copyright problem when you come to the publishing piece of the cycle. There is actually a materials problem acquisition problem when it comes to the hypothesis formulation and testing phase. And this is particularly acute in the life sciences. If you've read a paper about a certain kind of stem cell treatment for AIDS and you can't get the stem cells, it's very difficult for you to actually test your hypothesis. And when you begin to peel that onion, you find this incredible, nasty ecosystem of problems. Scientists are given funding based on a very competitive system. And so their instinct to transfer this kind of information to people that they don't know so that those people can build on it is pretty low.
The only established model for looking at the legal availability of digital content is the web. And Creative Commons has worked to build a continuum from no rights reserved to all rights reserved for creators and owners of content.
But I would actually challenge you to flip that and talk about the rights of the user being as important in some ways as the rights of the owner. So the owner has a right to the integrity of their work, to control the copies that are made of that work. But we should also be thinking about what are the rights of the user, because on the internet, the user becomes a creator as well. And this very traditional method in which we absorb culture and then we recreate culture, or we absorb scholarship and then recreate scholarship, it really is something where we're building on all of these things that are already there and already free. And we've had those rights in an analog world because it was too expensive to enforce the rights of the owner against the rights of the user before we got digital rights management and ubiquitous surveillance tools.
So once you have the ability to share digital materials and stop thinking in terms of printed media, the possibilities open up.
So the place where we're seeing uptake is in the life sciences, because there the information is so complex, multivariate, and large scale that we really don't have many choices but to begin taking a network approach to it. And we are seeing that once you can get a critical mass of knowledge into a graph format, that you can begin to use it to do incredibly powerful things. You can use it to extract very precise answers out of a very complex information space. When you want a list of genes that meet a certain set of criteria, Google gets you a list of papers, documents, web pages, or my blog, because the wisdom of the crowd says my blog is the most linked web page that describes this problem. And what you want is a list of genes. So you can use a graph to get a list of genes to see the provenance of all that information and do all sorts of very cool, nerdy stuff. You can also use it to do very sort of lightweight stuff. I mean, once you convert knowledge into this graph format, it becomes very malleable. So we were able to take the Allen Brain Atlas, for example, which Paul Allen put $80 million into. It's a giant visual map of where genes are turned on and off in the mouse brain. It's beautiful. So when we had done the reformat of this into a graph, what we realized is that it was trivial now to put it into Google Maps so that you could zoom in and out, drag and drop, and you could annotate, because the functions that were created for Google to add comments about hotels like this one that we're in, that same functionality can now be leveraged by scientists to collaboratively annotate these brain images.
The proof of concept that Science Commons has created is called the NeuroCommons, which is essentially trying to create a modern pharmaceutical knowledge management system with the free sharing of data and research. But another challenge to creating the semantic web for the sciences is the technical aspects of the network. What would a real knowledge browser entail? Wilbank says that the progress for that is really just beginning.
There's a whole lot of technical work you have to do to make this work, because the structures of the internet for computers and the web for documents don't scale to knowledge. Right. We don't have a domain name system for concepts. We have a domain name system for documents. So if you want this sort of stuff, you've got to go out and do some significant technology infrastructure work. And you have to deal with the fact that the software for the end user is really not there yet.
John Wilbanks, Vice President of the Science Commons Project. If you'd like to hear my entire interview, you can find the link on our show notes at connect.educause.edu/now. And if you'd like to find out more about the Science Commons, visit sciencecommons.org.
We know that the economic crisis has created increasing challenges for you and your institution. Your travel budget may have been slashed. Funding for professional development probably isn't what it was. EDUCAUSE offers you countless ways to develop valuable professional skills, network with colleagues facing similar goals and challenges, and get involved with your community without breaking your purse strings. Check out free virtual seminars, discussion groups, volunteer opportunities, and other ways you can engage with EDUCAUSE at www.educause.edu/pd. EDUCAUSE, uncommon thinking for the common good.
The term edupunk has garnered some attention in recent months. It's defined by Wikipedia as an approach to teaching and learning practices that result from a do-it-yourself attitude. The New York Times defined it as an approach to teaching that avoids tools like PowerPoint and Blackboard and instead aims to bring the rebellious attitude and do-it-yourself ethos of 70s punk bands like The Clash to the classroom. The term edupunk was coined by Jim Groom, instructional technology specialist at the University of Mary Washington. His friend and colleague is Gardner Campbell, director of the Academy for Teaching and Learning and associate professor of literature and media at Baylor University. They have some disagreements about the term edupunk, so we sat them down and let them have it out. We'll be featuring video of their full discussion in February. But here's a little excerpt, starting with Jim Groom explaining his ideas on the term edupunk.
The logic to me was, why are we doing all this cool stuff only to have it incorporated and taken out from under us by big corporations that are basically claiming Web 2.0 now, new Ajax stuff. And the fact is, people have been doing it like this for years. I mean, this doesn't start with any one person, doesn't start with any one logic. And the idea of edupunk as an approach makes sense. The do-it-yourself kind of, you know, build your own spaces. But edupunk could have been just a word that we wouldn't even be talking about right now. The fact is, it hit a nerve somewhere. Because, I mean, there was obviously a really deep-rooted reaction to a term that became quickly a concept. Some would argue a meme. I would argue an ideology. And how much edupunk crosses over with the idea of punk. And then people started to obviously bring that metaphor, and people had problems with that metaphor.
What is edupunk to you, Gardner?
I think it's a great idea, and I think it's the wrong metaphor. Partly because I'm pretty cynical about punk culture. The flag-bearing punks, the Sex Pistols, at the end of their last tour, very famously, confronted the audience and said, "Do you ever feel you've been lied to?" And it's just another cultural blip. Now, having said that, everything about the DIY spirit, everything about the fluorescent light at LMS, which is a brilliant way to describe it.
Which I take from a post by you.
Well, there you go. I didn't know I was congratulating myself. I guess that's a punk thing to do. You know, all of that I am not only in sympathy with, I think the reason edupunk took off the way it did as an idea, as a term, as a rallying point, is that a number of people suddenly said, you know, I have had enough. You know, I think it's more like that moment in Network, where everybody's outside the window saying, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. Now, in the movie, that doesn't work out so well either. And what I'm interested in is building something that is sustainable as an alternative so that we don't cycle through this again. You know, so that the next wave is, well, somebody who's so bored with edupunk invents another fluorescent light at LMS, because it'll happen. Every revolution spawns a counter-revolution. So maybe the revolution paradigm isn't the one we want. Maybe there's another one there. But where I do agree is that it's time. It's time for us to think about this differently. And it's really where Jim and I are in complete agreement. I just think it matters what metaphors you choose, what words you use to describe it. And I think in some ways, punk for some people, not for Jim, is a kind of easy ride. You know, oh yeah, stick it to the man, you know, let's... And it really isn't that. It shouldn't be that. I don't think we should think about leadership or really generative authority in that way.
One of the things I think that me and Gardner, we agree on so much, but we don't always agree on other things, is the question of leadership.
That's right.
And the question of leadership is whether, in fact, the leadership is going to show us the way. Whether that comes together in some real way outside of leadership. And leadership, kind of like UMW blogs, can control the... helpfully control the way that goes, rather than saying this is how it should be or that how it shouldn't be. I mean, a kind of means by which you recognize what's going on, and there are going to be people in power, you allow it to happen.
Well, but you see, this is where I think we agree without understanding we agree, which is kind of interesting to me. I never think of leadership as who's the person who's going to show us the way. I think of leadership as who's the person who's going to give us permission to see that we're thinking about the way. Because that stuff doesn't happen automatically. People need someone to say, you know what? I value the fact that you're thinking about this, and I want you to understand that this is actually making something generative happen in the environment. People don't do that on their own for a lot of reasons. It really is the leader who is able to make the table big enough for the people who need to be there and to say, here's a way to be here in good faith.
That's
so
right.
Here's the problem. Edupunk is not interested in changing institutions.
as a meme, the way I look at it, because that's going to take diplomacy and patience and persuasion. And it's going to take convincing people that we can be together in good faith. Edupunk is more like, who needs institutions? No, at least that's the superficial appeal of it, and I think that's where it goes awry.
But I think that's wrong, because I think when you take the idea of small pieces loosely joined, and you say to faculty, and you say to students, you know what, put the power back in your space. You know, you take your RSS feed, you get your own space, you publish it here. We build something as universities people can publish with. But we don't basically say, well, I'm glad that the leaders made this point. I'm glad that everybody who's in power established that this is how we should feel. I mean, you put the responsibility back on the individual.
Okay, who's you? Who's you? A leader, in this case, a leader named Jim Groom, did the ultimate act of leadership, which was to create an environment and administer an environment, not all alone, believe me, so that these voices could emerge. The voices didn't do it. You see, I think it's important that we not lose track of the fact that someone who is in a position to make this empowering happen does it.
But it's the problem with the great figure idea of history. All I did is take recommendations from people to read different blogs of different things that were happening within the blogosphere and to see what they're doing and just add another piece. I mean, the idea of a single name recognition in the context of telling a narrative
right. Is
what we need to do, and it's part of our impulse, but it's also dangerous at the same time.
Okay, so I want to say two things in response to that.
Okay.
One, my Milton teacher in graduate school said we practice biographical criticism because we want to know whom to thank. So there's another way here in which the community understands the leader, not as the person they should bow down to or the person they should say, oh, all blessings flow from, but here is the person who has sacrificed something for us. Now, let me give you another example. It was an act of leadership when George Washington refused a crown. It was an act of leadership when George Washington said, two terms, that's it, I'm stepping down. And you know there were people who would say, oh, well, that wasn't leadership, but it was, because only he at that moment, as a great figure, could say, time for somebody else to do this.
There's two different ways to approach these questions, right? There's the intellectual history, right? Or the idea that there's that social history where this stuff is happening. It's out there. It's boiling. And never before have we seen that as with these tools now.
But what do you do with the idea of agency? WordPress multi-user didn't just appear. People actually had to be intentional. Is that not leadership?
It's an actual act towards something. I think the idea of leadership here is kind of being conflated with the idea of working towards a goal.
Jim Groom and Gardner Campbell will have video of the full discussion coming up in February.
How to get faculty to do what you want.
John Fritz is Assistant Vice President of Instructional Technology and New Media at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
With apologies to faculty or IT colleagues who feel like my title is presumptuous or grounds for career suicide, I want to counter a trend I've noticed at a few instructional technology conferences and on email lists. The IT staff member as victim, or worse, as whiner. I can't get faculty to come to our workshops. Faculty don't want to teach online. Why would they listen to me? To be sure, there are real institutional issues behind each of these statements. But what also lies behind them is a subtle issue of confusion, or is it control, about who is responsible for integrating teaching, learning, and technology. Is it us? Is it them? Truth be told, it takes a village to transform learning with IT. But in my experience, some instructional technologists have to understand the timing, circumstances, and faculty motivations that create their unique brand of IT teaching moments. So, assuming our hearts and minds are pure, I'd like to propose three golden rules to get faculty to do what you want. Number one, most faculty teach the way they were taught, and most weren't taught with technology. Nobody wants to look silly in front of a class, but after years of formal education and being anointed as experts, how is it the faculty are expected to learn to use technology in their teaching if they weren't taught with it? In many cases, especially for early adopters, the reward of better teaching or learning may not seem worth the risks, knowing just enough to be dangerous or taking too much time away from their real jobs. A few years ago, one of our history faculty, Joe Tatarevich, gave a talk for our Brown Bag series called Night Sweats of a Geek Humanist Professor. One of our most savvy early adopters, Joe said he'd reached a point of wondering what the university really wanted him to be doing, mastering the latest instructional technology or professing his subject matter expertise in the history of science. Joe chose wisely and does not work in our IT department. But notice what's going on here. Faculty have to take time away from doing something familiar to do that which is not. Is that their job? Can instructional technologists make it easier? In order to reach the land of Oz, they have to leave Kansas. And that's hard. Through our hybrid course redesign program, we've learned faculty have to return to being students without being made to feel this is what's happening. We thought the key to doing so is a $1,500 stipend they receive for completing specific program requirements. But given the amount of work they put into getting ready, I think there's something else going on. While it may appear I'm making faculty do something I want, using technology in their teaching, I'm actually leveraging their innate interest in teaching well to fully experience the IT training we offer them as students. In other words, by reconnecting to their own learning styles and preferences, they experience hybrid learning as a student might. More importantly, I'm appealing to the curious, inquisitive nature of most faculty who will look at almost anything that purports to make a better connection with their students. But with all the options available to them, which ones will faculty entertain? This leads me to my second rule. Number two, most faculty learn best from other faculty, not instructional technology staff. Despite what we may like to think about our own teaching, which we call training, faculty don't learn best in a formal workshop, though we offer one to each of the faculty in our hybrid program to help them meet requirements for the one-time course development stipend. One key to the workshop, which is offered 6 to 9 months before the faculty will teach their first hybrid course, is that we always include a lunchtime presentation of these same deliverables from a previous cohort of faculty that has taken our workshop and taught a hybrid course. This is more important than the technology we demonstrate. This also sets the stage for the new faculty to see how they might approach their two deliverables they'll have to present a month or so after the workshop. This assignment is the same for all of the faculty who want the course development stipend. Give a brief 10-minute presentation about one assignment, learning object, or activity that students would experience if your hybrid course were to start tomorrow. Some presentations are better than others, but it almost doesn't matter. Because no matter who is presenting or how well they do so, when I look around the room, I can see their colleagues making mental notes of how they might or might not teach the way they were taught. To me, this reflection on pedagogy is, or should be, the real goal of any instructional technology support program. Once faculty become more aware of our pedagogy as IT trainers, or, ideally, their peers, the contrast with their own allows them to better see and make the changes that are necessary to teach in a way they've not learned in the past. No matter how persuasive or effective I might be as an instructional designer or technologist, there is no substitute for faculty hearing what works or doesn't from a peer, preferably in one's own discipline. As tempting as it may be for us to feature IT support staff telling faculty about this or that technology, we rarely do so because we want to shine light on the faculty who actually make it happen. Finally, we are trying to systematize this important peer mentor role by publishing our most active Blackboard courses. Since 2007, we've been developing and studying better reporting than is currently available in our Blackboard course management system. Specifically, using an average hits per user approach, we now publish and rank UMBC's most active Blackboard courses after the last day of classes every semester. By publishing the most active Blackboard courses reports, it is now possible for faculty to seek each other out about what works or doesn't in using Blackboard. Using these activity rankings, as well as annual user surveys where students are asked to identify one faculty member who uses Blackboard well and why, we have begun to identify exemplary faculty for short show-and-tell screencasts and effective practice interviews where the faculty member explains how and why they use Blackboard. Knowing what faculty want to achieve leads me to my third rule. Instructional technology should solve a pedagogical problem or create a new student learning opportunity. Before I worked in IT, I was UMBC's PR director and used to work a lot with news media, who I find to be very similar to faculty. Both are innately curious species who are bombarded with too many input channels and demands on their time. The only difference is a reporter's expertise is wide and shallow, whereas a professor's is narrow and deep. In hindsight, I was okay at my job. But I got better when I realized I first needed to pitch stories I knew the reporter was interested in, rather than the press releases my institution wanted me to pitch. It took longer, but I built credibility and trust first, and then used that to slowly try to take the reporter where I thought we had a story with legs. I try to take the same approach with faculty, by first trying to understand where they want to go, and then using their own inertia to help take them there. Sadly, I think some IT staff get tagged with a reputation of being in love with this or that new fad. Do we live up to the stereotype? Eager zealots with a solution in search of a problem? Do we understand what it's like to teach? Can we apply technical knowledge to meet real needs? Do we even listen? Sometimes the best way we build credibility with faculty is to be able to honestly say when using technology might not be appropriate. We need to learn what technology can and can't do, and then honestly share that with the people who come for us with the help in using IT in their teaching. I found the faculty appreciate our candor enough to come back for more, and that's when you know you've hooked them. On the other hand, I've also learned if a faculty member doesn't know the problem he or she is trying to solve, I can't really help. That's when I push back. I'm not saying I won't talk to instructors who don't have answers to these questions, but be careful of the request that goes something like this. Can you show me how to use more technology in my course? This could be a moving target. I want to show the right technology, which they alone can judge by what they want their students to learn. But if faculty aren't intuitively attracted to the problems our technology solves, we may have to provide incentives that grow a critical mass of early adopters who can identify effective practices and influence their peers. That's an added cost of time and money we don't often talk about, but it is essential if we want instructional technology to scale up in the real world of teaching and learning on most campuses. So, given all of these complex and sometimes competing motivations, how should we proceed? Here are some suggestions. Listen for the pedagogical problems faculty want to solve or the new student learning opportunities they want to create. Relate this knowledge to real opportunities afforded by instructional technology, but know what it can and can't do. Help any faculty member who shows interest. Your time with them can plant seeds that lead to bigger wins. Shine light on those who are successful in applying what you've shown them. Ask them to tell their peers how you helped. Respond to inquiries for help versus waiting for them to appear automatically. Always treat a faculty member's peer referral of another colleague to you as manna from heaven. And absolutely always follow up when a faculty member specifically asks for your help. To be clear, my own experiences at influencing faculty and my institution are a work in progress. But the longer I do this work, the clearer I see my role and how I can help. I found that if faculty can just see an example of how technology might be used, they're often very creative and willing to adapt the technology to their needs, and usually for the benefit of student learning. In closing, let me borrow and adapt a few lines from the Tao Te Ching about true instructional technology leadership. The best technologists are scarcely known by their faculty. The next best are loved and praised. The next are feared. The next despised. They have no faith in their faculty, and their faculty become unfaithful to them. When the best technologists achieve their purpose, their faculty claim the achievement as their own.
John Fritz, Assistant Vice President of Instructional Technology and New Media at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find out more about the stories you heard, check out our show notes at connect.educause.edu/now.
And let us know what you'd like to hear. Drop us a line at podcast@educause.edu.
I'm Colleen Luckett for Educause Now.
I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.